I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
He was our 43rd president, and during his 8 years in the White House, he helped shape history.
The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens.
Confronting terrorism after 9/11, sending troops to war, and with policies that sometimes divided the people.
The strength that he exhibited after 9/11 is something that I think will really stand the test of time.
I think of trillions of dollars in debt spent fighting an illegal and unjust war.
Now the legacy of George Bush's administration continues with the opening of his presidential center on the campus of Southern Methodist University in Dallas. During the next half hour, we'll talk to the director of the center, Bush's former communications chief, and others as KERA takes you inside the Bush Center. I'm Shelley Koffler. The first shovel of dirt was turned in the fall of 2010 as dignitaries and friends crowded under a tent at Southern Methodist University for the groundbreaking. Now, after raising more than $500 million in private donations, the dignitaries are returning to see the results and to pay tribute to George and Laura Bush as they dedicate their presidential center tomorrow. It sits in the middle of a native prairie landscape on 23 acres that include a museum, library, and institute. Exactly what will be on exhibit has been a closely held secret until today. KERA's Lauren Silverman was among those inside the Bush Center for a look at the gifts from foreign leaders, a replica of his Oval Office, and some interactive, high-tech attractions.
From the moment you enter the Bush Center, you're surrounded by technology. In what's called Freedom Hall, a 20-foot-high wraparound screen takes you on, well, sort of a 7-minute magic carpet ride. You start out alone in the desert of West Texas. A tumbleweed passes by before you fly far from the Lone Star State to the U.S. Capitol. You soar above the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. Then high-definition images of everyday people pop up. A woman doing yoga, football players, a cowboy, before faces of former presidents and the nation's founders appear. The Bush Center expects 400,000 people will walk through this dome every year. Mark Langdale is the president of the George W. Bush Foundation.
It's a tribute to presidential selection and leadership and the people of America.
Langdale says if visitors can pry their eyes from the screen, they'll see the Bush Center building is also a tribute to Texas.
The stone on the walls is Texas limestone. The ceiling is coffered Texas pecan, the state tree of Texas. So it has a lot of touches that are really personal to the Bushes.
And as you stroll through, you'll notice the museum is laid out in a way that reflects Bush's actual experience in office, starting with the exhibits on the domestic issues he thought would be his focus: education reform, tax cuts, community and faith-based initiatives. But as you round the corner, your walk is interrupted by mangled metal from one of the Twin Towers.
We just got a report in that there's been some sort of explosion at the World Trade Center in New York City.
The names of those who died on September 11th serve as a background for the video screens flashing archival news coverage.
Tonight we are a country awakened to danger and called to defend freedom.
At an interactive glass-top table, you can pull up photos, documents, and maps to learn about the invasion of Iraq. But it's not until you enter the room called the Decision Points Theater that you get to decide how to handle the crises that defined Bush's presidency.
The drumbeat of criticism has been loud, and it's growing.
Picture Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, except instead of Regis Philbin, your host is one of Bush's former chiefs of staff.
You were asked how to address the threat of Saddam Hussein. You had three options.
You can use one of two dozen touchscreen terminals to consult advisors. You have 4 minutes to study each scenario: the war in Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, the troop surge, and the economic crisis.
I think a lot of people will be surprised at how hard these decisions really are.
Brendan Miniter is senior editorial director of the George W. Bush Institute.
This is a vehicle for helping people spend more time than they would necessarily in an exhibit to really sort of process what it's like to deal with conflicting advice and have to decide. At the end of the day, the buck, you know, stops with you, and you got to decide what to do.
Every exhibit is designed to make you feel like you're in the former president's boots. So does all of this technology put you there?
Time's up.
You decide.
This is the 13th presidential library to be operated by the National Archives and Records Administration. In many communities, the addition of a presidential library can have a dramatic impact. In Little Rock, Arkansas, President Bill Clinton Center has revitalized the downtown, and it's added a wealth of new activities for the community.
So we're about to look at our replica of the Oval Office here.
Visitors to the Clinton Presidential Library and Museum are suckers for the full-scale replica of the Oval Office. It even meets the cool standard of eighth graders like Casey Williams.
They have the replica of the moon rock that is passed down from each generation of presidents.
And Emily Matthews, who was still in diapers when President Clinton left office.
I think it's amazing how alike they got it to the original thing, how much detail was put into it.
The chronological exhibits that depict Bill Clinton's achievements and disappointments are still a big draw. But Jordan Johnson of the Clinton Foundation says the exhibits are just part of the reason that 9 years after opening, attendance is healthy and increasing. And many of the visitors arrive by school bus.
The president wanted every child in Arkansas to be able to come in and learn the history, but also show them what is possible. Every school group that comes through here gets in for free. We have great programming here that ties in with the STEM-type teaching system. We have programming around the exhibits.
Education is at the heart of what's happening here, and it goes beyond events during Clinton's 8 years in the White House.
My dear fellow clergymen.
In an auditorium, hundreds of kids take part in the reading of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail.
I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely.
Sixth grade math teacher Wendy Dotson says the center brings history to life for her Little Rock students.
It's not just a movie on the screen. It's the real artifacts that are right there. And, you know, how cool is that to know that someone from Arkansas was so influential?
Historians come here to study documents and records. The University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service next door hosts lectures with world leaders, and it sends students to work on projects around the globe. Jordan Johnson of the Clinton Foundation says Heifer International, which works to end hunger, chose to build its headquarters down the street.
This center put Arkansas on the international map.
The Bush Center will also draw hundreds of thousands of visitors to Dallas. One big challenge for Alan Lowe, the director of the Library and Museum, was to figure out a way to organize the many artifacts and exhibits.
We have over 40,000 artifacts in our collection. We have 70 million pages of paper and so forth. So there's a paper document. So there's a lot of things to pick from. But we want to make sure when people came into the exhibit, they were able to learn, they were able to be entertained, and they were able to look at various levels of information. So you can go through a fairly quick walkthrough and learn something. But if you want, you can dig deeper and find out more information about important events. Obviously, we talk about September 11th and the war on terror, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But this exhibit begins really with the 2000 election and his focus on the domestic agenda. So you see that No Child Left Behind, tax reform, those types of things. You turn a corner and suddenly you see a 22-foot piece of steel from the World Trade Center. And that's where everything changes. Certainly everything changed for our country and the world, but it definitely changes in this exhibit as well.
You have tried to reflect the president and the first lady's principles in your organization, and you have several different key concepts.
At the end of the day, what we did was we said, let's think about these 8 years, let's think about these people, and how do we present this story in the best way? So it's not necessarily a straight chronological telling of their lives, but more looking at different issues and developments and events of the administration. So again, we talk about 9/11, but we also have great areas where people can interact and learn more. The Decision Points Theater, I think, is probably the coolest part in that way, where people can go in for a few minutes and act like the president and choose from different scenarios and decide how they would make decisions.
How do you deal with the controversies?
We don't not talk about important issues that were controversial. So Katrina is talked about in the Decision Points Theater. In that, you'll hear completely divergent views on what should and should not be done. Mm-hmm. And you get to pick, what would you do? The same thing with the financial crisis and so mm-hmm. forth. So those issues are there. And I would also say, from the National Archives perspective, when you look at our archives, our concept always is let the record speak. So we are trying very hard right now to process those papers so that we can make all this material accessible so that over time people can really see what made this president tick. Definitely we've wanted his input throughout this, saying what were you thinking, what issues were important to you at this time, and so forth. And the same I would say with Mrs. Bush. She's been very helpful, very, very, very much engaged throughout the whole process.
Can you talk about the other things that people may not be so familiar with that this presidential library and center will be and do for the community?
So already over the past two or so years, I've had a great education specialist on board, and she's been working with K through 12 schools in this area, seeing how we can be helpful to them. So in areas like teaching of history and civics, but even beyond that, if you think about all the issues a president has to deal with, we have materials here and throughout the National Archives that are very useful in classrooms on a wide, very wide range of subjects. Education is core to our mission, but also public programming. So how can we bring in great speakers, put on conferences, do symposia, that type of thing? We're now doing a series of speakers with the Center for Presidential History at SMU, bringing in presidential biographers. That's something that will grow.
How will you be bipartisan? So this isn't just viewed as some kind of reinforcement of the Bush perspective.
Well, I think you'll see in our programming, we're not necessarily bipartisan, we're nonpartisan. So we bring in speakers that are relevant to the subject. We're here to educate, to inform, and to bring in the best possible people, regardless of party or perspective.
This will be a research institute. You will have presidential scholars and other academics who will come here to study, to look at the records. Why is that so important?
If you really want people to take an active role in the civic life of their community, they need to understand how it works. And we're about providing the information to help teach people how things work, about why presidents, why administrations took the actions they took. These records are there for us as citizens to come in and examine. The National Archives is proud to be the repository of those records. So we take them, we process them so people can gain access to them and make them available. I love archives. They are the raw material of history. If you want to understand something, you can't just take the gloss, the initial view of something. You need to dig deeper. The way you do that is looking at the archives.
The new digital era has also brought another challenge to the archivists. What to do with 200 million emails, 4 million photographs, and an untold amount of video. Lauren Silverman takes a look at how they're tackling it.
Preparing a presidential library has typically meant sifting through thousands of boxes filled with old papers. And for archivists working on the Bush Library, that's no exception. But this time, they have a new challenge, sifting through massive hard drives.
We have 80 terabytes of electronic records, which is an unprecedented amount of electronic records for us.
Brooke Clements is with the National Archives and Records Administration. It's her job to preserve and review the president's electronic treasure trove, which means someone reads through each and every file to decide what to redact for personal or national security reasons. And in case you were wondering, those 80 terabytes she mentioned, that's 8 times the entire print collection of the Library of Congress.
So that means that our 200 million emails would be about 1 billion pages.
That's why they're turning to the web for storage, where they can post unlimited amounts of video, digital photos, and documents. The library already has some online. There are also videos. A whole gallery devoted to Barney and Miss Beasley. Yep, the Bush's beloved black Scottish terriers.
Celebrate America. That's a great way to spend our last holiday here in the White House.
These videos weren't particularly controversial. It's more complicated for electronic files like emails. Researchers who want to dive into the email goldmine will have to wait until January to request access. That's because presidential records aren't available to the public until 5 years after a president leaves office, when the Freedom of Information Act kicks in. Adam Bergfield is an archivist at the Clinton Presidential Library. He remembers the day Clinton's material went public.
Within the first few hours of accepting Freedom of Information Act requests, we received hundreds and hundreds of requests by telephone, by email, by fax.
The Clinton Library had 20 million emails to deal with. The Bush has 10 times that.
that's only actually a small percentage of the email traffic that went on during the Bush White House.
David Gowertz is author of Where Have All the President's Emails Gone? He explains it's only emails sent through official White House accounts that are delivered to archivists.
President Bush's interaction with email was simply, I'm not touching it, period. Because he, and probably rightly so, believed that his statements in a casual communication might be misinterpreted. And so he just completely avoided using email. On the other hand, his staff used email tremendously.
Researchers will have to be patient. It's going to take decades for archivists to sift through those virtual mountains of electronic data.
The emails and documents that will eventually be available to the public will tell the story of a presidency with loyal supporters and fierce opponents. As the center opens with exhibits and programs that could shape his legacy, we wondered, what do Texans most remember about George W. Bush's administration?
My name is Jason Graff. When I think about the Bush administration, I think of an unnecessary war, the war in Iraq. I think of being lied to as an American citizen. I think of trillions of dollars in debt spent fighting an illegal and unjust war.
My name is Sarah Wilson, and when I think of the 8 years of President Bush's presidency, I think of a time when America came together on a lot of issues. We were very divided, but the strength that he exhibited after 9/11 is something that I think will really stand the test of time.
My name is Chelsea Morrell, and the No Child Left Behind has really impacted my mom's life. She's a teacher of 11 years in Wichita Falls, and she's not a huge advocate of it at all because she feels like it's a hindrance and she's not too big on the whole standardized testing.
My name's Carrie Velotti, and what I remember most about the Bush administration is how dedicated Laura Bush was to education and how much she valued children and our future. I really appreciated that about her.
But what we're learning is that a presidential center is a whole lot more than a record of what an administration accomplished or failed to do. James Skip Rutherford led the planning for Bill Clinton's presidential center in Little Rock, and he says controversies surrounding the institutions tend to disappear over time.
Every presidential library, school, and institute are controversial. It's nothing new. I mean, it comes with the territory because...
What was controversial here?
Oh, well, first of all, the Clinton administration, the issues associated with his administration. Some thought he was too liberal for Arkansas, and some thought that this school, public service, what's that all about? I mean, you get all the questions. But let me just tell you, though, here's the issue. The issue is what George Bush is doing for Dallas and for SMU is really wonderful, and it's a good deal. And why it's a good deal is because presidential libraries and institutes and schools are about the future, not just about the past. And so this thing is going to go on and live for a long, long time. And secondly, people need to stop thinking contemporarily. They don't need to judge George Bush or Bill Clinton or Lyndon Johnson just on their presidency. They need to judge them on their lives. And as we've seen with the Johnson Library, as we've seen with the Kennedy Library, as we're seeing with the Truman Library, the Reagan Library, you'll see the same thing with the Clinton Library and the Bush Library. This is going to be a gift that keeps on giving.
And that was Skip Rutherford from the Clinton Presidential Center in Little Rock. Now, while many of us remember those select events from the George W. Bush administration, Karen Hughes no doubt remembers them all. She was a key member of the strategy team that helped President Bush win 2 terms in office. She then served as trusted counselor to the president and oversaw the White House Office of Communications. Karen Hughes has also been instrumental in planning at SMU, and she joins us now to take us inside the Bush Center and to talk more about what we will learn about the 43rd President's administration that we may not know. Karen, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Shelley, for having me.
You know, the behind-the-scenes facts are always illuminating. You had a seat at the table throughout those 2 terms. What generally don't we know about this administration that you think we're going to find out when we visit the library, the museum, and the center?
Well, I think the museum does a wonderful job of really leading you through and showing you how President and Mrs. Bush's actions were rooted in Texas and in the values that they learned growing up in Texas. The you know, you literally walk in and you see the night sky of Crawford and the day afternoon sky of Texas, and you get a sense of the wide open possibility and that Texas can-do spirit, and you're grounded in family and faith and community and the sense of service. And so you walk through that, and then you come to the campaign and the very tangible things on which he campaigned: tax relief and education reform and work on immigration reform and the compassionate conservative agenda that he outlined. And then you walk around a corner, and just as on that horrible day in September, you're shocked and horrified. You see the twisted beams of steel. The president told the editorial director of the museum that he wanted the museum to present the facts and let people decide for themselves. And at the end, the people have a chance to go into a Decision Points Theater, it's called, where they're presented with four of the most challenging decisions President Bush faced during his presidency: the Iraq, the surge in Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, and the financial crisis. And they're given some of the same conflicting information the president was given, interrupted by breaking news. And then they get a chance to decide for themselves what they would do.
You mentioned 9/11. I think most of us looking back would see that as one of the defining moments early in his presidency, when he stood at ground zero following the terrorist attacks. The words he spoke at that time really resonated around the world. Let's listen now to what the president said on that day.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
I was standing a few feet away from him when he said those words. It was totally spontaneous, unplanned. He had already spoken earlier that day at a national prayer service, and we realized that the rescue workers wanted to hear from him. And so one of the staff members found a bullhorn, and he stepped up and said that. And I was standing next to a friend, and I turned to him and said, "That's going to be in his library someday." Because I realized what an important moment it was. Completely spontaneous, yet such resolute conviction in the face of the horror that we had witnessed on September 11th.
How will you use that moment in illustrating something bigger about his presidency?
Well, I think that moment shows his resolve, his character. You mentioned that 9/11 was a defining moment. It was the defining moment. Everything about his presidency was changed on that day. The first time I saw him that day, he was at the bunker in Nebraska, and he practically came through the television screen and he said, "We are at war against terror. And from this day, this is the new priority of our administration."
As you know, there were also some other moments that were a little more difficult during the presidency. The federal government's inability to respond effectively following Katrina, that was a tough time. The controversy surrounding the war in Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. Here's what the president said about that, going into Iraq, and this is August of 2006.
"The main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq. And I also talked the need to advance a freedom agenda. And so my answer to your question is that imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein was there, stirring up even more trouble in a part of the world that had so much resentment and so much hatred that people came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and then, you know, kind of the stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned."
So that was President Bush in August of 2006 talking about Iraq. He mentions the weapons of mass destruction issue that became so controversial. How will the center deal with those moments that were contentious?
Very straight on. There's actually a clip of President Bush in the museum saying we were wrong. Our intelligence was wrong about the weapons of mass destruction. Not only our intelligence, but the intelligence of all our intelligence services all over the world. And he takes that very head on. And there's a clip in there. People may be surprised to find Condi Rice, a film, talking about Guantanamo and talking about enhanced interrogation. And so, again, his instruction was to put out the facts, put out the good and the bad.
What do you think this library and center will mean to his legacy?
I think it presents the history, and what we hope it will do is help shape the future. Because as you leave the museum, you literally cross a line in the floor where he goes from being president to being citizen. And it's really a call to service. And through the ongoing work of his policy institute that is also at the Presidential Center, he will continue to be engaged in policies that we were all passionate about in serving in the Bush administration. So education reform and global health and economic growth and human freedom. And for me, I'm particularly passionate about a women's empowerment initiative, trying to provide leadership training to women in the Middle East so they can chart their own futures.
Those are some of the initiatives in the Bush Institute. There have been some concerns about it from academics at SMU that there are political, conservative kinds of things, and maybe they will polarize the community at SMU. I'm wondering what you think the Institute's role will be.
Well, I think most of those concerns have been assuaged. In fact, the SMU faculty is very much involved in a number of the programs. The Women's Empowerment Initiative that I just mentioned is based on some research by a member of the SMU faculty that shows the importance of a woman's network in helping her have influence in her society. We have a shared fellow in global health who is both working for the Institute and on the SMU faculty. So there have been a lot of different linkages with SMU, and we think it's a very strong partnership, and it's been very well received in the academic community.
You know, it occurs to me that a president's work really isn't over when he leaves the White House. There's so much more that presidents are doing these days. Jimmy Carter with his Habitat for Humanity, monitoring voting around the world. Senior President Bush and President Clinton, very involved in public service activities around the globe. What will George W. Bush be doing in the future?
Well, he has said politics are behind for him, but he's continuing to work on policy that he cares about. And so you saw him, for example, in Africa, working on a cervical cancer initiative. Cervical cancer is the leading cause of death for women in Africa. And so he's building on the amazing AIDS work that he did, saving millions of lives in Africa. Education reforms is something that he and Mrs. Bush, as a librarian and school teacher, feel very passionate about. And so they're continuing to work with improving public schools, human freedom. During his time as president, he met with dissidents. He met with freedom fighters. He's continued to invite them to SMU. Plus, he's taken up painting, which is... I was very surprised. But, you know, he and Mrs. Bush both have realized what a difference they can continue to make. And he really will devote his energy to the Institute for the remainder of his years of service.
The George W. Bush Center at SMU opens to the public on May 1st. Our guest has been Karen Hughes. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I hope everybody will come and enjoy it. There's a beautiful park.
The park Karen Hughes is talking about is 15 acres blanketed by native plants and prairie grasses. It's part of a goal to develop a destination that's environmentally sensitive. KERA's Jerome Weeks takes a closer look.
George W. Bush's environmental legacy as president was decidedly mixed. He established the largest protected marine environment in American history, more than 100 million acres set aside in our Pacific territories. But he also permitted more mountaintop removal by mining companies, and he refused to sign the Kyoto Protocols on global warming. Yet the George W. Bush Presidential Center is unequivocally eco-sensitive. Peter Arndt is walking on the gravel pathway through the park that makes up a large part of the 25-acre Bush Center. Arndt's the director of design and construction. He's coordinated everyone from the architect to the contractors.
For me, this is a great hallmark in my career.
That's because the 65-year-old Arndt has never helped create a platinum building before. Platinum is the highest LEED certification. LEED, L-E-E-D, stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. The designation is awarded by the nonprofit group, the U.S. Green Building Council. They have a long checklist, everything from the ways a building uses energy to whether the construction materials were recycled. Only a handful of buildings in North Texas have been verified platinum. Peter Arndt says platinum status is especially difficult for museums, like the Bush Center.
You have lighting. You have lots of lighting. You have very strict requirements for the preservation of artifacts.
That means museums eat up a lot of energy. Actually, Arndt says the Bush Center had a number of things going for it. It's basically a broad, flat-topped building. There's a lot of roof space for solar panels.
That has allowed us to capture 13% of the project's energy needs.
And then there's the public park. It's a mix of blackland prairie with the limestone boulders and gullies of the hill country. That's where they've buried a 252,000-gallon cistern. It collects all the runoff to provide half the center's irrigation needs. But the drainage is more than a technical feat for Arndt. The water flow makes the park move and change.
When you have a rain event, water will be coming out and spilling like small waterfalls, which I think is probably One of the more remarkable things about a site, it's not just plantings and trees, it's also what happens in a natural landscape.
So there's a public park, a library for research, a museum with hundreds of exhibits and activities, an institute that's working on programs here and abroad. That's what a privately invited crowd will dedicate tomorrow, and what the public can explore beginning May 1st. KERA News will have more coverage tomorrow of the Bush Center dedication on 90.1 FM and online at keranews.org. This KERA special program, Inside the Bush Center, will also be archived at keranews.org. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, with contributions from Eric Bright, Stella Chavez, Courtney Collins, Justin Martin, Lauren Silverman, Jerome Weeks, and Alexis Yancey. Rick Holder is our Vice President of News. I'm Shelley Kaufler.